Please be seated. Before we dig into today's reading, I have a public service announcement. As we've been noticing in this Genesis sermon series, themes keep repeating. You know, the first man and first woman conned by the serpent into going on their own against their Creator, who somehow, he said to them, can't be trusted, who doesn't have their best in mind. And so they say, we know better how to run our lives. We'll take it from here. And they demand. And each self-centered, rebellious step leads to disaster after disaster. They trade less and less on God's way to live, and they turn more and more to serpent habits. God still rescues them. Adam, Eve, down to Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Esau and Jacob. Okay, here's the announcement. One of the big reasons why the book of Genesis reads the way it does, and it's really important, and I don't want us to gloss over it. I mean, any of y'all at this point listening to this weekly series and thinking, you know, I find these ancients really backward. Slavery, polygamy, bride, purchase, daughters don't really count. Customs like giving the elder son almost all the estate while leaving the second son the scraps, goes on and on. All these customs devastate people's lives, don't they? Folks, the Genesis narrator is exposing these practices, not condoning them. No attempt to smooth over, airbrush, or minimize the offense in the Genesis record. It's witness to God having to deal with his humans behaving very badly while leading them to his ways of living. Okay, thank you for your attention. Now back to chapter 29 and to Jacob's dealings with Uncle Laban and his daughters Rachel and Leah. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? This chapter is going to reveal to us, let's put it in three ways. One, the hell that Jacob and Leah find themselves in, and by extension, any one of us willing to admit it. Two, how the living God intervened to rescue them and will do the same for any of us. And three, what his rescue is, the cost of it, and how we can have it. So first, Jacob and Leah in hell. What do I mean by that? Well, we may have time to hear more about this coming up in the spring, but I wanted to take you to C.S. Lewis's amazing story, The Great Divorce. And there's a sample from it. The setup for The Great Divorce is that it's a fantasy story, but people in hell get a bus ride to heaven every now and then, and they don't have to come back. It's an amazing setup. But Lewis has one of his favorite mentors, the great Christian writer and poet George MacDonald, represented as being in heaven and coming down to meet with one of the visitors. And of course, they're very confused about where they are and why and what happened in the life they had before. And MacDonald tells them that heaven and hell actually work backwards into this life. And this is what he says. Both processes begin even before death. One's past begins to change so that his forgiven sins and her remembered sorrows take on the quality of heaven. Another's past already conforms to his badness and is filled only with dreariness. And that is why, at the end of all things, when the sun rises here and the twilight turns to blackness down there, the blessed will say, "We have never lived anywhere except heaven." And the lost will say, "We were always in hell." And both will speak truly. So today we find Jacob and Leah, and they're in a hell of their own. Remember, Jacob was spurned by his dad, Isaac, who didn't love him, but loved Esau, the older brother. Jacob was spoiled by his mom, Rebekah, And as the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, in his isolation and confusion, in the emptiness of his life, he lives a lie, life of lies and deceit. Jacob is a con man with a dark heart. So, fulfilling a strange prophecy that he would rule over the older brother, I smile when I see that because to me that's like God at work overturning these customs. He tricks the feeble Isaac, his dad, into giving him the bulk of the estate. He tricks Esau into going along with it. And now what does he have? He has no father and his mother is gone. He has no wealth yet, and he's on the run for his life, knowing that Esau is furious for revenge. Isaac's last counsel to Jacob is to search for his uncle, Laban, for work and a wife to start a family. So he tracks his uncle down, who's about to, and this is so important, you think Jacob was a deceiver, a con man? Wait till you meet Laban. Jacob is no match for Laban. They begin to talk wages since Jacob's going to stay there. And they, you know, this is a negotiation for salary and for terms. You know, how long do you want me to be here? What's my salary? It's a negotiation, right? But we have a problem. Jacob has met Laban's daughter, the younger home run beauty, Rachel, and then her homely older sister, Leah. Now, Jacob is a goner for Rachel. Maybe you know something about this. It's a little detail, but it's kind of cool. He goes to the well at the beginning, and it says it takes a couple of shepherds to move this heavy stone from the well. Well, Jacob comes to it, and Rachel shows up. And Jacob gets real puffed up and he says, "Watch this." And he takes the stone himself and moves it. Well, he's a goner. And he tells Laban he's going to work for 7 years for her. Folks, the negotiation has just blown up, even if Jacob doesn't see it yet. You see, notice that Laban does not say, "Yeah, good deal, there we are, terms, price, we'll do it." And the reason he doesn't is because at that time in the ancient Near East, the highest going rate for a bride price was around 50 shekels. Jacob's offer of 7 years' work adds up actually to about 130 shekels. Almost triple the amount. Laban doesn't have to say a word. He knows already that he's got his nephew in the palm of his hand and won't be hard to manipulate. What a screw up for Jacob. 7 years fly by. The wedding day arrives. The bride is heavily veiled, as was the custom. And she's veiled throughout the ceremony and into the evening party. Folks, this is a wedding party. There's lots of drinking. Jacob takes his bride into the darkness of his tent. And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. You see, Jacob had plans, but as the heavyweight fighter Mike Tyson said famously, "Everyone has a plan till they get punched in the mouth." From here on out, Jacob's going to get gut punch after gut punch. Leah, she has plans too. She has her kind of emptiness of soul. And she looks for something to fulfill her desires. And she wants more than anything to have Jacob to love her. She wants to be a mother. She wants to have the status in that culture that married women have. She wants to be somebody. She wants to know her life will count. To know that she's not what she has put up with all her life as the ugly duckling of the family, unloved, unwanted. Now is her chance. But as husband Jake pours 7 more years of toil toward his plans, she knows she'll never get what her heart longs from her husband, who only wants to fly into the arms of, get this, the sister under whose shadow she has struggled miserably all her life. Jacob and Leah, they're both unloved. They're empty inside. They think if they just finally find their true love, or they finally find something that'll make them feel like they're somebody and that they count, maybe true love will do it. Maybe happiness will do it. And they go about it the best way they know how, which turns out not to be the best for them by a long shot. They're poster children for the tragic and self-centered, lost and wandering human race. Jacob and Leah in hell. Well, part 2 of this, into their struggling, God intervenes. How does he do it? It's good to see it. You see, the living God, the actual God of the Bible, knows them, but knows us too, you, better than we know ourselves. He knows our deceitful hearts. He knows our quirks, our successes and failures, what each of us has been through, exactly what we have done and left undone, each individual story. And watch what he does here. He uses Laban, Uncle Laban, to humble his nephew. You see, Jacob needs the equivalent of a 2x4 to the head, and Laban is happy to help out. Jacob angrily confronts Laban for tricking him, and Laban levels him with a blow. But this blow is not just it's not the outside blow, it's a blow deep inside the core of him. You can see it in verse 26 if you want to follow along. Laban says to Jacob, "You want my reason for tricking you like I did? Son, around these parts we honor the older first, not the younger." Why doesn't Jacob fight back? I mean, fraud is fraud, right? Why doesn't he call Jacob out on it? I mean, why doesn't he call Laban out on it? You know the reason. Jacob the younger had stolen the older brother's honor and wealth for himself, and that's come back to bite him. He's fallen into his own trap, hadn't he? Famous Jewish commentary on the scriptures is called the Midrash. It was written about 400 AD. Writes about this moment in Genesis, and it imagines Jacob in his wedding tent crying out. The deceiver is now deceived. His sense of sight taken by the darkness, like his dad Isaac, who was old and blind, remember, having to rely on touch alone. Jacob cries out in that dark tent, "Rachel!" And she answered him. In the light of morning, he realizes it was Leah. He asks her, "Why did you trick me, daughter of a deceiver? Didn't I call for Rachel last night and you answered?" Leah looks at him and says, "Well, isn't this how when your father called out Esau? That's how you answered him." More gut punches are going to land until Jacob is humbled and ready for the biggest showdown of his life, where he meets far more than his match. And amazingly, blessings to come. Stay tuned for next week. Leah begins to receive her rescue in the way best for her. You see, her heart needs changing too. If only I had a husband who loved me, then I would be okay. She has a child, and she names him Reuben, meaning to see, hoping that Jacob would at last see her for who she really is. Doesn't happen. The next child she names Simeon, meaning to hear, hoping that this time Jacob would listen to her. She called the next child Levi, meaning to attach, hoping that at last Jacob would grow attached to her. Well, you know what happens. Jacob is attached to Rachel. Somehow, after all this, Leah's heart is moved by the personal, loving God of Israel. And she grows to see that no husband, no wife, however close, however loving, or distant or cold, can bear the freight of her heart's desires. And that's true for you and me. We're not talking about bad things necessarily, even good things, but if we attach ourselves to them and make them ultimate things, they're just idols, and they will fail us. But the true God won't. A son once again is born, and she names him simply Praise, or Judah. She sets her heart's hope on God and simply praises him, asking for nothing better than knowing his presence and loving kindness. She will go on, and this is so incredible, she will go on to be honored beyond all she could imagine. Because you see, through her son Judah's line, Jesus will be born. Leah is Jesus' ancestor. The Lord's painstaking rescues of Jacob and Leah would signal for all his people through time, and yes, down to any one of us here who are drawn to him, the ultimate rescue, and it's only found in his son Jesus. How so? Well, in the chapter right before the one we were reading today, you're familiar with it. Jacob is on the run for his life. In the desert, he lies down on the ground, and he's given a dream, turns out by God himself, of a stairway between heaven and earth where angels come down and go up. Upon waking, Jacob realizes God is personally seeking him out. He assumed that the stairway was a place. He would later realize that it is not a place, but a person. Centuries later, a man born in David's line, a descendant of Judah, would tell his followers, as recorded in John's Gospel, chapter 1, that he himself is the stairway between heaven and earth, where angels come down and go up. Now, I've heard it called Jacob's ladder, and maybe you have too. It can be confusing. Not just because a ladder isn't exactly a stairway, but also because the world's religions, including, unfortunately, some strains of Christianity, tell us that the highest goal of life is to climb that ladder up to God, or to whatever they say is ultimate. God's at the top, and the ladder rungs are virtues, good works. And if you do enough of them and are moral and honest enough, you can make your way up to him. But biblical faith is completely different. You must hear me. God, the God of the Bible, is not like that. In Genesis, and all through the Bible, we encounter really messed up people. People who don't seek after God, don't deserve his grace, actually resist his grace, and often don't appreciate it when he gives it to them. God has to come all the way down to meet them where they're stuck. That's your story and mine as well. And as one of my betters put it, the true moral of the story is that our morals won't get us into God's story. God has to come down into our stories. And the leaves of the Bible rustle with the report that he's actually come down in real time, in our history. to us, seeking us through his Son. I know what the world is like. We might prefer a designer God in radiant beauty, here to offer us a designer life of ease and goods, fame and fortune, better looks. But when he came down in Jesus, he looked much like his ancestor Leah, born humbly with no beauty that we desired him, as Isaiah foretold. He was despised, unwanted by this world. He was a man of sorrows, accustomed to grief. And he stooped low, all the way down to death on a cross. And in his life, perfectly lived for us. And in his horrible death in our place. Do you see? He fulfills all the demands of being right and acceptable to God for you. And if you and I can't admit that we can be saved only by the sheer grace and mercy of the man hanging there in our place, then we're too proud for the incredible rescue of salvation come to this world through Jacob, Leah, and their destined child. He became weak and ugly that you and I might be given his gift of forgiveness, a right standing with God, and the eternal life of radiant beauty that will never fade. Amen.